Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Quick, name the most disabling illness in America. It's also the one that causes the most lost time and productivity in the workforce. Well, the answer is depression. It grinds more time off the lifespan of adults than all the cancers put together. It's estimated to steal $40 billion from this country's economy each year. Peter Kramer calls it one of the most devastating diseases ever. And yet there will always be people who say, wait, it's not a disease, not like Parkinson's or TB. Many people see depression as a condition, a state of mind, a period of gloom or melancholy that we're all susceptible to. Well, if that's your perspective, you're going to get an argument from Peter Kramer. He's the guy who wrote Listening to Prozac. He is in favor of using drugs to treat depression, and his latest book is an even sharper, more personal look at depression. We'd like to have you join us. Are we ever really going to understand depression? Is it a disease like cancer or asthma, or will it always be wound up with creativity and the suffering of artists, things more heroic? Can we ever imagine a time when people no longer have to fear depression? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter Kramer is here with me in the studio. As I said, the title of his new book is Against Depression. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And this wasn't, I understand, the book that you set out to write. You set out to write more of a history of melancholy.
I thought I'd come back and do that, but I found myself in a certain posture, which is caught between different perspectives on depression. After listening to Prozac, I started getting a number of complicated cases of depression in my practice. So I was living with chronic recurring depression in patients. And at the same time, I was speaking to audiences. And in every setting, I thought that I detected a gap between what I as a doctor believe and what researchers and scientists believe about depression and people's informal attitudes, which were either more stigmatizing or, I think the more interesting story is, more likely to romanticize and idealize depression.
You talk about the question that comes in these public readings, you know, what would happen if Van Gogh took Prozac? What would happen if Kierkegaard took Prozac? And I got the impression from your book that you took this question so often, it started to get pretty frustrating for you.
Yes, I think I took it lightly. I answered automatically. And then, you know, one day you wake up and you say, wait a minute, this is a very strange question. My moment came in Copenhagen, where, as you say, I'd been hearing about Poe and Van Gogh. And I was speaking to the Scandinavian Society for Psychopharmacology, a serious group, and I felt a little like Jerry Lewis in France. I mean, I thought, here I'm getting respect at last. This book was translated into Finnish and Swedish by the most exquisite translators, introductions by the great researchers. And, you know, sure enough, I finished my usual talk, and the guy is there in the audience, and he says, what if Kierkegaard had taken Prozac? And for various reasons, I knew about Kierkegaard, and he was writing in his diaries about suicide and how hard it is to earn each day. And I thought, this is what Scandinavian psychopharmacologists do. They're out to diminish depression and suicidality. What kind of a question is this? It's outrageous. So I woke up to it, and it seemed to me a sign that something was wrong in the way that everybody, including doctors and psychotherapists, think about depression. Wrong in this sense, that at least there were two simultaneous lines of thought. One, this is serious disease. It's eroding the brain. It's harming the heart. It's harming blood vessels. And the other is, this is something we can joke about. It's tied to creativity. It's really just an extreme case of the artistic temperament. I mean, there are probably 20 different ways of underestimating depression.
Is it then a problem with language, Peter, that, you know, I'm as likely to hear my daughter say, I failed my math exam, I'm so depressed about that, as opposed to what you experience in your practice, which is so genuine?
It's a little bit a problem with language, but if you think of the case of Van Gogh or Edgar Allan Poe, who, by the way, I don't think necessarily had depression simply. They were, in one case, epileptic, and the other case, both probably epileptic and one alcoholic. But, you know, we're naming examples that are not merely having stubbed your toe on the math test. We're naming examples of people who went on to do great harm to themselves. So I say to audiences, I started to say to audiences, well, define depression however you want. Is it a disease in this sense that we would be happy to eradicate it? Would we be pleased to have no human being need ever suffer depression again? And people would, you know, even given the chance to define it at any level they wanted, people would say, well, are we altering human nature, I'm not sure. And I think there is no other disease that calls out the hedges and caveats the way depression does. So if you said, if we could eliminate arthritis or dental cavities or cancer, everybody would say yes. No one says, well, hold on, let's keep the minor cases on hand.
There is a part in the book where you cite a study that was done of writers at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Yes. Was it staff that at the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
It was a large percentage of people who came through. I think it was everyone who came through, and it wasn't students, but it was staff visiting writers and successful writers.
And what comes from that is an acknowledgement, a recognition that there is some mania. Is that the word that you use, that affects their creativity, either inspires it or flattens it or does whatever?
Well, this is an old study. It was supposedly a pilot study, although the study to follow it was never done. And it was written up in the New York Times to say that depression is related to creativity and writing. But I went back and looked at the study, and in fact, what it showed was that manic depression, which I take to be a separate condition, and these new biological and brain studies confirm what psychiatrists have been saying, that it is separate, and alcoholism seemed connected. But where the connection was not statistically supported was simple major depression. So I wondered how many of these studies that we think are showing that depression is related to creativity actually are showing something else. And I think the category is just broad. So there were early claims about schizophrenia, later claims about manic depression, which, is good for a lot of things. That stage just before mania where you're very active and making quick connections to your mind seems to be good for business people and politicians. But the case for depression, it seems to me, very weak.
I want to take a call from Somerville, Massachusetts. Diana's joining us on the line. Diana, what are your thoughts?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am myself a recovering addict, and part of addiction and depression can often very frequently be all mixed up together. And I'm a musician. And when I came into recovery and started to get well, mentally, my artistry just skyrocketed. It really just went to new levels. And because my mind was clear and I wasn't full of the fear that depression causes,
So this thing, Diana, that we're raised with, this notion that the tortured artist produces good music or good writing, what do you say to that?
I think it's bunk. I think it's bunk. I've been on both sides. And I like this side a heck of a lot better. And the feedback I've gotten from my colleagues, from my mentors, from my family, who are also professional musicians, is nothing but, wow, boy, you sure have come a long way as a musician since you've been getting better.
Well, this is what doctors say. This is what memoirists say. And even the few studies that look at manic depressive illness, where, as I say, there's actually a better case that there may be a connection with depression, and where the medicines, by the way, are quite dulling, some of them given for manic depression. Even in those studies, it looks as if people get more creative on the medicine, and it's very rare people who are doing better are doing worse creatively.
There's something that Diana said that I wanted to ask you about, Peter, and that was in her recovery she noticed, what she could do. Because I think this is an observation of yours as well, that depression itself is so hard for either for a patient or a doctor or anyone to describe, that you focus on people who are just coming out of depression as a way of measuring it. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, I think depression is insidious. And when you're in it, you're likely to say, I've done bad things, I'm guilty, I deserve this fate, and not to think of it as disease.
Or maybe really I am a bad person, I'm not depressed, but I have no self-esteem.
Exactly. This is entirely appropriate to my condition. And I start the book out with cases of recovery, because I think when you, in my case, walk into the waiting room and see someone who's better, it's entirely clear that they were in an alien condition, that they were afflicted by some disease. When you see them better, they move differently, their voice is different, the sparkle in the eye, the radiance of the skin. I mean, just it's clear that they have recovered from a disease. And I think it's often after the fact. I start the book actually with a tale against myself, which is that years ago, before these new antidepressants, I had worked with a patient in psychotherapy, and she had made all kinds of self-accusations about her relationship to her daughter. And we discussed them seriously in the treatment. When she came out, she said, you were negotiating with an alien. that was not the person I am. And yeah, sure, I've done some, you know, made some mistakes. What mother hasn't with her daughter? You know, people are that way. The kids come out pretty well. That it wasn't even that we should have been discussing this at the level of accusation. I'd been very delicate, I thought, in my interpretations. She was saying, we shouldn't have been discussing it at all. You should have said to me, when I said I feel guilty about what I did with my daughter, you should have said, that's what people who are depressed do think. You know, to say, identify that as a symptom of a disease and be done with it. And that may be an extreme position, but I think we do need to move in that direction and say there is something very distinctive and different about the depressed state, and it is not the whole self. It is not the true self.
And the point that you make in observing the return is that it's not just the doctor's eye, but it's the people who were depressed. They will say, I am back.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not like it's a foggy thing for them. When they come out of it, it's so clear.
Yes. And I was worried that some of the arguments or worries I'd made about medicating people in listening to Prozac, where I was worried about the use of medicine to change personality, I was worried that those concerns were now being applied promiscuously to illness. And I didn't want that to be the case. It's quite legitimate to treat depression with illness if we can be successful at it. With medicine.
I was going to say. Anyway. Peter Kramer is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Against Depression. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Is there any question in your mind that depression is, in fact, a disease? Do you look at it from a different perspective? Do you want to take Dr. Kramer on with that? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon. Peter Kramer is here with me in the studio. He's the author of a new book called Against Depression. You'll remember the book that he wrote in 1993 called Listening to Prozac. Peter is a professor of psychiatry at Brown University, hosts his own public radio program called The Infinite Mind. One of the observations that you make in the new book, Peter, which is, I think, key to where we are today, is that since the time when you wrote Listening to Prozac, so much has changed in the science, the biology, the biological understanding of depression. What's key to know?
Well, I think what's key to know is that there's anatomical difference in the brain, and that difference isn't just a different way of being a human being, one versus the other, which is the kind of result one might have found. It's disorganization, it's pathology that looks like a variation of the kind of problem we see in some neurological diseases like Huntington's disease, and it's probably cell atrophy and parts of the brain getting smaller in volume. I want to start at a point that I don't start at in the book, which is late-life depression. There's some depressions late in life that are caused by small strokes in the brain that are called silent strokes because they don't affect motor movement, they don't affect vision or hearing. But in some patients, they cause depression. And if you take patients with silent strokes and on a mathematical basis subtract out those who have silent strokes and don't have depression, and those who have silent strokes and do, you find that the key areas are damaged in a couple of parts of the brain called the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus. Well, what has happened in the last 10 years or 12 years is a couple of discoveries, really a series of papers, that say in ordinary depression, the kind that's caused by a combination of genetics and trauma and stress, in those depressions, there are very similar changes in the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus.
You mean if the death of a close loved one put someone into a period of prolonged depression, that you could see a difference in their brain after that period or in that period of depression?
That is what these studies show. There are two kinds of studies. There are autopsy studies where they look at a little brain slice in people who have died suddenly, say, in a car accident, but have had depression during their lifetime. And there's disorganization in this social part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. And there also are studies in extremely healthy women who either have had no disease at all, major disease, or no disease except that they've had depression. And the differences in those women are that a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which has to do in part with turning off stress responses and also with emotional memory, that part of the brain is smaller in proportion to the number of days a woman has been depressed. These are both findings that came out in the early 1990s, and they really changed the way doctors look at, think of, and treat depression.
And so has, in terms of how it has changed the way people treat depression, has it given you some sense of reassurance? You know, this is not stuff we're still trying to make up, but we can point to physical changes.
We can point to physical changes. It looks as if the treatments that we have to hand, like medication and psychotherapy, affect those very parts of the brain that we're worried about based on the pathology. And just now, in the last few months, there have been studies about putting electrodes deep in the brain for very depressed patients, turning them on. And the parts of the brain that are energized when those people recover through this surgery and electricity look to be the very same parts of the brain that we say are disorganized when we do the pathological studies. So it looks like we have the complete story. We don't have the complete story about what depression is, but it looks as if the pathology is what we call an inherent pathology. It's not like saying, well, alcoholism is a disease because it relates to cirrhosis of the liver. Mm-hmm. This is saying depression is a disease, and the pathology we're seeing is, at least in part, the pathology of the depression.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take a call from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Patrick's with us. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. Thanks. Dr. Kramer.
Hello.
I want to agree, of course, with the first part of your argument, namely that depression has been romanticized. I think that's a very important point to make. But the second component is that depression is a disease. And the grounds for your argument that it's a disease are the physiological changes that you just discussed, like brain tissue damage, for example. But it could also be a symptom by that argument, because fever, for example, is a symptom, but fever, at least at high levels, also causes brain tissue damage. I think it's important, that distinction between disease and symptom, because if doctors were to treat fever as a disease, for example, they wouldn't look for the deeper causes, nor would they notice that fever can be caused by many things.
Well, there are diseases that can be caused by many things. I mean, a given cancer can be caused by environmental causes and genetics, and there may be a behavioral component, as in smoking. So I think in this culture, we say that when something is syndromal, that is when there are a cluster of symptoms that come largely in conjunction, and when it's partly genetic and partly due to environmental causes, and when it gets worse over time, and when it has a distinctive physical pathology, and when the many forms of it have the pathology in the same form in the same places, that is what we call a disease. And I think that the problem with calling depression a disease is that there's some ideological opposition to this. In other words, think of Thomas Szasz and the myth of mental illness groups, who are worried that making depression into a disease, discovering that it's a disease, will give excuses for coercion and political repression and so on. This movement really grows up in response to fears about totalitarianism. There's a resistance so that no level of evidence perhaps would be convincing. So I always want to know, when I'm in this discussion, what would convince you that depression is a disease? In other words, if discovered that what is harming predisposing the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex to harm is largely viral, would that convince you, or are you unconvincible altogether? So I think we always have to know what the premises for the discussion are. Yes. But I think that there's plenty of evidence that it's a disease.
I was wondering what would convince you that it's a symptom.
What would convince me that it's a symptom? But what is, in other words, I having seen it, I guess I would be hard to convince that it's a symptom. It seems to be a large cluster of symptoms, from these guilty ruminations, the suicidality, the problems with eating, the problems with sleeping, the inability to experience pleasure, so that it just seems to me that in our culture, when something has that syndromal form and particular anatomical things wrong, we say it's a disease.
Patrick, it's Dick here. Is this a sort of semantic argument over the very use of the word, or is there a part of you that doesn't like the idea of defining depression as a disease?
Well, maybe I could take an example from his book to show that it's more than a semantic distinction. He talks, for example, about a psychoanalyst at a conference who refused to vigorously treat, and I think by that Dr. Kramer means refused to use drugs to treat, someone who had apparently narcissistic problems. And the psychoanalyst's argument was that it was good that this narcissist was experiencing a depression, because it gave him the motivation to go through an extensive psychotherapy. So that depression actually can be beneficial in some circumstances. Now, Kierkegaard said, for example, that the worst kind of depression is the depression which does not recognize itself as such. So that if someone lives a life so constricted that they never encounter the situations that would make them depressed, that can be worse than if they were to expand and actually encounter those circumstances.
So you want to make place for depression as something that is constructive, not completely destructive. Is that what you're saying, Patrick?
Place for it in some circumstances. I think you're right with the romantic critique that people think, oh, if you're depressed, that's great for everybody. But I think for some people, rather than living a constricted life, such as the narcissist in your book, it can be good.
Well, I think, Patrick, that this objection points out why disease is so important a category and why we're discussing it. I don't say that a psychoanalyst has to use medications if the psychoanalyst had been focused on improving the depression first because he was worried about, say, damage in the brain and downstream damage to the heart and blood vessels and so on. I would, perhaps respect that approach. I would respect that approach, especially if it was succeeding. But I think that the question I would have for the analyst is if this were a depression were caused by anemia, say, if it were caused by low red blood cells, would you let it persist because it was helping you with a narcissism? Would you bleed the patient if the depression failed to persist? If it were cancer, would you let the cancer persist because it helped with the narcissism? And I think on the whole, we don't want our doctors to take that kind of posture, certainly not without consulting openly and closely with us.
You use the example of the poet A.E. Housman in his poem Terence, where he tells the story of an ancient king who took poison in increasing doses, so when the enemies put arsenic and strychnine in his meat, he was unaffected. And I wonder if there's a parallel in that story to what Patrick is saying, that part of the kind of suffering we're talking about is suffering that builds up a resilience, which makes you better able to avoid depression. How do you define that suffering then?
I think we would see depression differently if we thought that depressions made us resilient. The problem, and I think this is the evidence of the last decade, is that depressions make us depressive. They make us less resilient. So your second episode of depression, if you have one episode, you're likely to have a second. If you have a second, you're extremely likely to have a third, fourth, and fifth. And that the later episodes last longer, they have more symptoms, they're harder to treat. There's then a shorter interval between subsequent episodes. And some of this data, even if it's wrong by a bit, would still be extraordinary. There was one study that showed that if you'd had two major episodes of depression, that if a researcher then contacted you at any point in your life subsequently, on any given day, the odds were 50-50 that on that day you would again or still be in an episode of major depression. So it's a very recurrent disease. And the problem is exactly a problem of eroding resilience. I don't think that humanity, by the way, will lack for suffering if we get rid of this particular disease, depression. Depression, as it's pretty much now defined, there's plenty of journeys for people to take even without their being depressive. And I think, part of what I play with in that Terence, this is stupid stuff, Housman story is, if the culture had better resources, would poetry really need to steel us against the bad hour in this way? To what extent is Housman focused on depression? To what extent is it human suffering and the human condition in general? And I want to make those distinct categories.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Wellesley, Massachusetts, Stephen's on the line. Hi, Stephen. What do you think?
Hi, Dick. Hi, Dr. Kramer. How are you today?
Hi.
I think that there are two major stigmas and one other stigma that is being improved that is militating against our culture accepting depression as a disease, which it's, in my opinion, most assuredly is. I think that the rugged individualism, the pick yourself up from your bootstraps, self-reliance, historic roots of our early history as American settlers, flight from religious persecution, is exacerbating the stigma. It's preventing the American psyche from being more compassionate about depression because mentally it's kind of unseen. There's still a cancer cell, but there's still no depression cell. Exactly, specifically from the standpoint of cytotechnology, and people just feel naturally and instinctively that this is something that you can, quote, overcome. This is mental, and this is an assault against the self-reliance ethic of our culture that goes back to the beginning of American Revolution. And I think also connected to that works synergistically is that talking therapy if it continues to still be used as a viable treatment, it will still protect this kind of stigma.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is one of the functions of bringing forth the neurology and the evidence about the degree of suffering and depression. One of the things I did with audiences in response to this Van Gogh question was to say, well, Van Gogh's doctors and to some extent modern neurologists as well thought that Van Gogh had epilepsy. He was being treated for epilepsy. You see that portrait of Dr. Gachet with the digitalis sprig in his hand. That digitalis is with a foxglove sprig. The digitalis is made from foxglove. It was a treatment for epilepsy in those days. And, you know, why don't we say, what if Van Gogh could have been treated for his epilepsy? What if anticonvulsants had been available in Van Gogh's time? If we imagine we had both diseases, what is the essential difference between the diseases? And I think the difference between the diseases is largely how visually evident epilepsy is. It's clearly different from normal. You have the, you know, muscle shakes, you have the loss of consciousness, the falling to the ground, which are the external equivalents of the storm in the brain. And if there is equivalent disorder in the brain and depression, the fact that you don't see the external stigmata of it except through behavior, that really is the only difference between the two.
Stephen talks about observing depression as a doctor observe a patient or so you'd observe someone with depression in your family at using that idea of the individualism and
right.
You can pull yourself out of it. You talk to patients who are in depression. Are they also, in a way, captive of this, you could pull yourself out of this if only you had the will to do it, and that's part of the sort of American
Absolutely. I think they are ashamed that they are not better yet. They think they can do it on their own. Sometimes maybe they can, but I think often they come to treatment very late because they have been making fruitless efforts that no one reasonably would think were going to be fruitful before they're willing to seek help. There's something shameful about this sort of help, and it applied for years to psychotherapy, and it applies to medication as well, I think, at the moment, that this is a crutch, the usual metaphors.
Let's go to Joan, who's joining us on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Joan. How do you see this?
Hi. Well, I really was furious when I heard Patrick arguing with Dr. Kramer. I've been on medication since 1991. I've been on disability for the past 5 years. It's a very frustrating disease. I'm on four different medications now, and they help a little bit, but they're not enough to get me back into being a functioning person. Yet I'll have days where I seem like a perfectly normal person. And, you know, if somebody asks, well, what's wrong with you, and you say you're depressed, they just kind of, you know, look at me and say, well, you look fine to me.
Do you wish that you had a rash or a cast or something that was evident, you know?
Absolutely. You know, they don't see the days, you know, where like seven, eight, 9 days at a time where I can't even get out of the house.
Right. I think they see you when on the good days because you're out of the house on the good days.
Exactly. And, I think even people in my family who know me and, you know, in some cases who even know a fair amount, you know, I have one relative who is a psychologist, I think there's still this sense that if I just really wanted to, I could fight it and get back to being normal.
Do you find, Joan, that attitudes of those people who are close to you have in any way changed over the past 12, 13 years?
I don't think so. I think they're sort of resigned to the fact that this is all I want for myself and that I'm not going to change. And so they're doing their best to make sure that I can survive, you know, on my income and everything. But I don't think anybody's really convinced that, you know, I have a disease in the same way they would be if I had cancer.
Well, hang in there, Joan. I thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you, Dick.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Joan raises a really interesting point, and that is, how do people who are living with or close to people suffering depression, how do they take the kind of advice and analysis that we're hearing today from Peter Kramer and make that constructive? Does it make a difference to view depression as a disease, to look at it square on that way, instead of thinking that it is somehow the fault of the person who is suffering depression? 1-800-423-TALKS, the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Peter Kramer is here with me in the studio. We're talking about his new book, Against Depression. Just quickly on the point that Joan made prior to the break, Peter, this perspective of the people who live with people who have depression, it seems in Joan's case, and probably in many people's case, in part a large way that they define themselves, not by how they feel, but how people respond to how they say they feel. Do you know how?
Yes.
I mean, we
are reasonably good at treating depression. Large percentages of people get better. If you have depression and you're treated, you should expect to get fully better. But we're not extraordinarily good. I think the last 10 years have been frustrating. We do not have a lot of new tools to use. Maybe some are going to come into use just in the next few years. And if you have depression month after month, year after year, people will take that to be your personality, the level of energy, the level of complaint they will take to be who you are. And one reason I start the book with these tales of recovery is that, on the other hand, if you're a doctor and you've seen people recover from those states, you understand that is not their baseline personality. It's not who they are. It is like an alien being, as patients after the fact are reported to be. Sadly, also, if the depression goes further downhill and you have memory loss and you're sitting in a chair wringing your hands, repeating sad statements again and again, people will also then, by that point, understand that you really had something wrong with you. But we would certainly like to be able to interrupt the disease before it reaches those late stages. Yes.
1-800-423-8255 to Salem, Massachusetts. Mike's joining us on the line. Mike, thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi there. How are you? Great show. I think that Peter Kramer is one of the good guys, very clear and articulate in his thinking and writing. I am a psychologist. I've been diagnosed with depression. I take medications. I swear by them, but I do not believe that depression should be seen as a disease.
Mm-hmm. And why,
Joan,
Mike?
Well, when Joan spoke about her colleagues and friends not seeing depression like cancer, I think that it's not like cancer. In some ways, it's like cancer. In other ways, it's not like cancer. And a very simple and quick thought experiment could lead us to understand that. If we look at cancer, we identify cancer in the body, and we say there it is, and we ask the person how they feel. If they don't feel anything, we don't say, well, the person doesn't have cancer. However, if we look at the brain and we see the area that lights up when the person's experiencing depression, and we ask the person how they're feeling, it doesn't describe any of the depressive, quote-unquote, symptoms.
Mike, we're losing your line. I'm sorry.
I think we have the thought, and, you know, there are all kinds of diseases. The philosopher Hilary Putnam a number of years ago talked about the kind of disease like polio, where you could have all the symptoms of the disease, but a doctor could say, look, you have all the symptoms of polio, but you don't have polio because you don't have, you know, the signs of the infection. Whereas for multiple sclerosis, as it was at the time, we know more about it now, you could have all the symptoms of multiple sclerosis. You had multiple sclerosis. So that was a certain limited way, different. And there are some diseases. We know that multiple sclerosis is a disease. I think any reasonable Western cultural definition of disease would include MS. So depression is further along than MS was at that stage. I mean, we do have some signs that can be found in life on average. We have some particular slides where after death we can say the person had depression without interviewing them, very likely. And there are odd conditions, like there's something called pseudo-dementia. There's nothing pseudo about this, but people with a family history or past history of depression can go into a dementia that looks a lot like the dementia of Parkinson's disease, and it responds to antidepressants. And it's not as if interviewing them would do you any good. You know that it was depression in retrospect because of the response to the treatment. So I think we have cases of depression that look, you know, that fit any standard of disease. And we haven't talked about this, but there are all the other aspects, you know, that if you have a heart attack and have depression, the risk from that depression is greater than the risk for ongoing high blood pressure or even congestive heart failure. People with depression are much more likely to die at every age, and they die of all sorts of things, not largely suicide, but things like strokes and heart disease.
Give me an example of why depression would make me, if I was depressed, I'd be a greater candidate for a heart attack.
Well, probably what's going on is that there's what's called a stuck switch problem, so that if you're depressed, you're not turning off your stress responses quickly enough. So you have more of these stress hormones bathing the brain and bathing the organs. That does a number of things to the heart, and nobody knows exactly what the connection is. But one of the things is that your heart rate is less variable. And when your heart rate is more fixed, the way it is when you're, you know, excited and your heart is beating along at one rate, you're more likely to have arrhythmias. In addition, your platelets are hyped up in this flight or fight response, so they're stickier. And when you have stickier platelets, you know, as if you were about to be wounded, when you have stickier platelets, you're more likely to clog up your blood vessels. So it is thought that those are two reasons why you have more heart attacks, you know, if you have been chronically depressed. Of course, in addition, people with depression take less good care of themselves, and that may be a third reason. But even when you take out the self-care, exercise, and so on factor, there is a very large excess of deaths with depression, and this increases, the risk increases as you get older.
All right, 1-800-423-8255 to Carrboro, North Carolina. Andrew's with us. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Well, thanks for calling. Tell me what you think.
What disturbs me in the dialogue here today and throughout the medical community in general is a wholesale practice of labeling many people depressed who are justifiably grieved about the course their lives have taken. And I think that does two things. One, contrary to romanticizing depression, I think it stigmatizes healthy people by implying they're defective or abnormal for manifesting a reasonable response to circumstances as seen in the context of their personal values. And secondly, I think it belies what I would characterize as a vainglorious attempt by mental health professionals to gain control over something that is inherently beyond their control. That is to say, you know, diseases we can attack, we can treat those, but our humanity, you know, can't be treated. What makes us human, the joys, the sorrows, the sadnesses, and the hopes that we have.
Right. Well, I think this is sort of the, by the way, you know, I call this book Against Depression, and people sometimes jokingly say, well, who's in favor of it? The answer is people are in favor of it, and you can tell from the callers that there are people who say this is an appropriate response to life. I think the reason that we focus on things like progressive damage to the brain and the heart and so on is to say this condition that doctors, not just recently, but for millennia, starting with Hippocrates, have called a disease. I mean, it was certainly called a disease before we had much insight into the details of the brain. You know, really does behave like a disease. I think that is just the final piece of an argument that's been going on for millennia. But this type of response, I think, is what disturbed me after the over the last number of years. And I think we should point out that many people who are very sensitive, they think complexly, they understand the absurdity of the human condition, they understand things one might dislike about the current culture, they understand what's sad about their own particular circumstances. The vast majority of such people will never have a depressive episode. And I think they're fully human. The only difference is that they don't have this particular liability.
You make the point in the book about the, I think your character that you create is the accountant from Illinois, the person who says, is this it?
Is this all there is?
Is this all there is?
Yeah.
And that state of being self-aware or self-doubting in helping us sort of get to Andrew's point here about understanding the place of that in understanding depression. You're saying this is the type of self-reflection which really has nothing to do with being depressed?
I think so. That was actually not my example. It was an example by a philosopher who was criticizing me and saying,
okay,
look, here's the guy in Downers Grove, Illinois. He's got a new snapper mower. He's in a job as an accountant, and he wakes up one morning and says, you know, is this all there is? And I say, well, I've been practicing medicine long enough that when he wakes up like that, I want to know what's going on. That is, I want at least to be free to consider the diagnosis of depression, because when people have these dramatic changes in their approach to life, you know, sometimes they're just out on a great exploration. But we, I think, tend more often to misdiagnose in the other direction. That is, we miss an episode of major depression when there's a major change in perspective. And I had another dialogue with that same philosopher, which, not to embarrass him because he's a terrific guy, very bright, and someone I respect tremendously, but he challenged me, you know, would you give Prozac, where Prozac is taken to be some, you know, universally effective antidepressant, would you give Prozac to Sisyphus rolling his boulder continually up the hill? And I went back to the Camus essay, which is the one that makes Sisyphus the icon of existentialism. And Sisyphus, Camus says, Sisyphus was joyful. That is Sisyphus's happiness, his joy, his love of life, that puts him in touch with the absurdity of the human condition, and that we have to imagine Sisyphus happy, not just in the intervals walking down the hill. We imagine him happy in his free thought, his rebellion, his independence as he pushes the boulder up the hill.
Well, he has to be an optimist to keep on going, doesn't he?
Yes.
I mean, otherwise he'd stop and be squashed by the darn thing.
He's not squashed, and the reason that he stands as existential man is he's not destroyed by the absurdity of the condition or his own difficulties. And I wondered, why is it that the philosopher, who, as I say, is a very bright guy, made that automatic connection between the absurd condition and depression? There are many responses to the human condition. Most of them are not depressive.
1-800-423-8255 to join my conversation this hour with Peter Kramer. We're talking about his new book, Against Depression. We're going to Durham, North Carolina. Donna's with us. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I have just a quick comment. I have three family members of three different generations, my grandfather, my mother, my brother, who have suffered from depression. My mother in particular has long-term treatment-resistant depression, and I am a non-depressed family member, and I have found it very helpful to look at depression as a disease. It has helped me learn about what is going on in my family. It has helped me deal with that. I think my relationships with my family members are better because I understand what they're going through. I used to, when I was younger and didn't really know my mother was depressed, I used to argue with her over her, you know, depressed thinking. You know, why do you think this way? Why are you, you know, why do you say you don't have any friends, or, you know, you don't want to go with me somewhere? And I don't do that because I understand where that comes from now. When I didn't...
So how does it change your behavior when you sort of approach your mom knowing that or as it thinking of depression as a disease?
Well, I think it helps because we both think of it that way. She's also a nurse, so that has been helpful in our education. But it does change in that I think our relationship's better because I don't expect her to respond to me as someone who isn't depressed might normally do. I realize she's depressed, so I know that some of the things she may say or do come out of that illness and not necessarily out of what she would choose for herself. And that, yeah, you know, that has really helped me because I think when I was younger, I expected her to do something different. Just like a lot of people do, you expect someone to come out of it. You expect someone to, you know, feel better or lift themselves up. I don't expect that. And there's some sadness about that, I have to say, but...
Let's hear from Peter on this, Donna,
well,
perhaps.
Donna, I want to go off actually in an odd direction. I hope you don't mind this, which is to talk about your brother being depressed and you're not. And one of the very interesting lessons also of the past 10 years of research has to do with what kind of experience gives rise to depression. And it often is the case that brothers and sisters have very similar environments. They tend to grow up with the same level of affluence. They tend to have comparable forms of parenting. And it turns out that the kind of experience that causes depression is always what is called non-shared. That is, even if it's in common, it's mediated by a different prepared brain and mind facing that experience. There is almost no experience that uniformly depresses all people. So that it is, you know, it's very much the case that people in the same family, because they start out with different levels of vulnerability and different levels of early depression, will start experiencing the family in different ways. One will find it unsupportive, the other will find it supportive, even though the parents swear up and down that they did the same thing for both children. And I think that also gives us a sense of what the course of this is as a disease, rather than as simply, you know, a response to experiences that are put onto a clean slate of equal, you know, undifferentiated human beings.
Does that fit, Donna?
Actually, it fits very well, and we've talked about this. My brother actually struggled in school early on, had learning disabilities, and had, you know, I was the easy child, he was the more difficult child. I think we had different experiences in our family, even though we did feel like our parents treated us the same way, but they spent a lot more time working with him on things he was dealing with. And he's become a, right, you know, a productive adult who, you know, takes medication. But as children, my life, you know, seemed out of the box, seemed easier than his did.
Right. And this is something else that, you know, far from being disadvantaged, of course, things like sexual child abuse lead to depression. But if you look at families where that is absent, often it is the case that the parents actually, by their accounts and the kids' accounts, are putting more efforts into the child who later will turn out to be depressed. They know from early on that there's some difference.
So what's the question that you're being asked when you read now from Against Depression? If the question from listening to Prozac was, what about Van Gogh? What about Kierkegaard? It's a way of asking, Peter, do you feel like you're rolling the rock uphill in any way here in changing the conversation?
I do think I am. I would say that we haven't had this particular response on the air, but there is some response from fellow psychiatrists, which is sort of a you go guy, response, that they feel that I am expressing something which is pretty widely accepted in the profession. But I think it's true that if we think about the kind of questions we've had today, they're a lot like the Van Gogh question mm-hmm. there. What about, isn't illness justified in the way that we wouldn't call asthma justified even if there were allergens in the air?
It's in physical injury too. You think about it in team sports. It's like play through the pain. It'll make you a better athlete. I mean, where that comes from and how you make a link here is.
But if it were true that playing through the pain were helpful in the case of depression, we would be in favor of it. I would be in favor of it. It's just that the risk is very high. If you think that every day of depression is changing the form of your brain, you'd have to be very confident that playing through the pain is beneficial in order to take that risk.
Because the risk is so high.
Yeah.
You say one thing in the book I wanted to get you to help me with, and we're near the end of the program, so I'll ask you to be quick if you can. You say you've grown increasingly suspicious of alienation.
Well, I think, that Sisyphus example, there are different forms of alienation. There's the alienation we glorify in, the American male alienated novel, which is the alienation of suicidality. And there's the alienation of just being vigorously aware that there are problems in the culture, problems in our condition. And there's sort of a vigorous, rebellious, even joyous and optimistic alienation. And I think we don't give enough credit to that stance.
Great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Peter Kramer, author of Against Depression. He's a psychiatrist and professor at Brown. Is that right? Though the students at Brown haven't seen that much of him. He's still busy with his book and his radio program and opportunities like this to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.